All right, I think we can get started, and I'll just go ahead and start the beginning part of this, and then turn it over to Mr. Blanchard to go over each of the complaints. So we will call the meeting to order at 1 p.m. on Thursday, March 21st. Going through the agenda, I just want to make it sure that the complaint committee, upon a majority of the quorum of members, may go into executive session for obtaining legal advice pursuant to ARS 38-431.03A3 on any member, any matter on the agenda. The board reserves the right to change the order of the agenda items except for hearings. And there has been one change in the agenda today that we will be moving number or letter C on student complaints, Franklin Pierce University, complainant SM. We will move that to the first item that we will hear today based on a conflict that the university has. They need to get things done first. So that stated, we'll go through roll call really quick. Mr. Romano, I can see that you're here.
Here.
Dr. Leck? Dr. Leck, you're on mute. Dr. Boutte?
Present.
Dr. Boutte is present. Dr. Leck? Dr. Leck is here. I know I've communicated with her. And then for staff, Mr. Blanchard?
I'm present. Not sure why my camera's not showing my face up there, but that might be a good thing.
We'll fill it in. Ms. Rohn?
Present.
And Assistant Attorney General Jean Galvin?
Present.
So all are present and accounted for. The first item up will be the meeting minutes. So we'll need a motion from the board member to approve the meeting, the audio meeting minutes from the 9/28/23 board complaint meeting. Do I have a motion?
Mr. LeBlanc, can you just confirm they are posted and audible?
Correct, Mr. Romano, members of committee, they are posted and audible.
Very good. I so move that we approve the audio recording.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
A second.
Dr. Boutte seconds. Mr. Romano, for the vote?
Oh, sorry. Aye.
Aye. Dr. Leck? Dr. Leck is not available right now. And Dr. Boutte?
Aye.
Dr. Tate, by the vote, two ayes, one not voting, that motion passes. Okay. The first case before the complaint committee today is actually going to be number or letter C, 2024 PPE 0002, Franklin Pierce University, the complainant of SM. Mr. Blanchard, can you provide the complaint committee an update? Mr. Blanchard, you're on mute.
Sorry about that. Thank you, Mr. LaMountain. Mr. Chair, members of the complaint committee, first is so students are identified by their first and last initials. We don't use their full name for the record. So if somebody goes in and listens to the meeting, they can identify who you are. So we will use your initials for the purpose of this meeting. SM was a former student attending out of Indiana. She enrolled in the Master of Physician Assistant Studies, the hybrid program, which is identified in the report as the MPAS, the acronym. She was enrolled August 23rd, 2023. She withdrew on or about November 24th, 2023. Her contention is, in reference to the complaint, was that the advertisement that she received and the information that she understood was that this program would allow her to undertake her clinical rotations within her area, like in Indiana. There was conversation that she had with the institution about that. They indicated that the clinical rotations would either be in Arizona or Texas. There is documentation in the report and that was submitted by Franklin Pierce regarding that there are some opportunities where you could try to get a cohort closer to where you reside. That's in the information that Franklin Pierce submitted. The student also submitted, as you, I know you've had a chance to review this, the different advertisements, the social media information that showed and quoted in the report that you could be close to your home. And so that's the reason why she withdrew. Her option was either to withdraw from the program or take a leave of absence if she chose to withdraw. I think you have everything that you would need in reference to both positions for the student. SM is here. There are, and I hate to mess everybody's name up, so I'll just say Priscilla, and I'm not sure how to pronounce your last name. I know the dean's here, and that's my summation.
So if the committee would like to hear from the complainant first, so that would be SM. SM, are you available?
Sorry, Ms. Lamont, can you just remind everyone, we've had a chance to read the materials, so they don't have to rehash everything.
So that's perfect. So thank you, Mr. Romano and members of the committee. Again, the information that has been provided both by the complainant and by the university have been completely reviewed by the committee. So really a really brief summation of what the complaint is. But knowing that the committee has seen and reviewed all of the materials. So, SM?
Thank you. Knowing that you have all the information, just a real brief summary of my position is that when I applied to the school, all of the information I had indicated that I would be doing clinical rotations near my home. There was an article with a quote from the dean that said that was one of the benefits of the school. There was Instagram and Facebook advertisements that also stated that, and the school's own website stated that as well. And when I got accepted, I was told that I was accepted under the handbook for the year 23-24. I was told that on multiple occasions in multiple different documents. However, after I began school, they tried to change the handbook to state that clinical rotations were based out of Arizona and Texas, and took out the language that stated every effort would be made to find rotations near my home. As soon as I learned of this discrepancy, I did everything I could to find out which one was correct. I was being told, you know, the information I had was saying that I would get rotations near my home, but then I had this other language that was telling me I might not get it near my home. So I was very confused, and I immediately began trying to contact the school, different people, my advisor, the program director, and the dean. And I could not get any clear answers from them. As a matter of fact, I was treated rudely. And I was intimidated from asking questions about this. And currently the students there are still trying to get clarification on this issue because many of them still believe that they're going to get rotations near their home. I want to point out that PA school credits are not transferable. I cannot take my credits and continue my PA program at another school. So that money that I spent there and that time that I spent there is completely gone. I cannot use that to go to another school. And furthermore, as I was told by the dean of the school, if I withdraw, I have a red flag on me, and it would be, quote unquote, a hard sell for me to get into any other PA school because I have withdrawn from a program. So it was a huge loss to me to have to withdraw from this program. And the only reason I went to this school is that I believed I could do it in Indianapolis. I have never had any intention to move to Arizona or Texas, and I cannot. I have 5 children, 4 of whom are still in school, and I do not have the financial means to move out of state and take children with me. So that was never an option. That was never my understanding. The school knew that I was accepting that program with the intention of staying in Indianapolis. I wrote it in my writing sample they requested. I stated it in my interview. They knew that's why I was going there. And despite that, they made this huge change to the program and made no attempt to clarify that to me, no attempt to tell me. And when I asked about it, they beat around the bush. Like I said, I felt intimidated to ask. One student who asked about it was given a reprimand by the dean and told she was unprofessional. I was told I was rude and demanding, and it took many attempts to get information on this. And when I finally did, as soon as I did, I withdrew. I was not trying to get a free education. I was not trying to do anything untoward. I was just trying to figure out if I could do these rotations near my home, as I believed. And when I learned that I couldn't, I withdrew. So I'm going to just finish up by saying that even though the handbook said that rotations were not guaranteed, I believe that they would make every effort. And they then changed their mind to say they will make no effort. I wanted to even find my own clinical rotations near my home. They said I was not allowed to do that. And to this day, they will not help students find rotations near their home. They tried to change the contract unilaterally without informing me, without pre-warning me. And the new contract that they made was never supplied to me, and I never signed it. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, SM. Board members, any questions for the complainant, SM?
I'll jump in real quick. I did have a chance to review the documentation. I just wanted to express my appreciation. It was very detailed. It had great examples. It was structured very well and read very cleanly. So I appreciate the time you took in preparing that material. And that's why I don't have any questions for you, but I do have questions for the school.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other board member?
I would just echo Mr. Romano's comments. I felt the same as reviewing the materials.
Thank you.
Dr. Leck, any questions?
No, I'm interested in the school, also helping us understand.
Great, thank you. So we will then move on to representatives from Franklin Pierce University. Can I ask who is the spokesperson for Franklin Pierce? Anyone?
Gwen, you're on mute there.
Yes, thank you. I was looking for Priscilla, if she's able to join us. She was going to do this, and if not, I will respond.
Priscilla, I do not. Is there a Priscilla?
Sorry. Okay. Priscilla is the dean of our College and Health Natural Sciences. If she is able to join us, I'm sure she will add some additional information. We provided you a detailed response to the complaint, and I believe that you all have had an opportunity to look at it. There are a couple of things that I think, so that we're not going through the whole complaint, that I want to bring to your attention. And the first one is that in April of 2023, Ms. Murphy signed in her acceptance agreement, which explicitly discusses the supervised clinical rotations, are known as SPCE. And in it, it says The program does not promise or imply that exceptions to assignments will be accommodated, nor that students will be able to remain near their homes or families during the clinical year. So this is her acceptance. The second thing I wanted to let you know is that the Facebook and Instagram post that use the language can were in May, that doesn't imply the guarantee, and we have taken them out, taken them down because they were not as straightforward as we wanted them to be. And then again, when she signed her student handbook, it clearly states in D the agreement regarding clinical, which is that I understand that the MPS hybrid program assigns all clinical placements, and there is a no guarantee that I will be assigned to a specific location or a preceptor. I also understand that sites are subject to change, sometimes without advance warning. I understand and agree that during the clinical phases of the program, I may have to relocate for periods of time during availability of clinical sites, and that I will be responsible for providing my own transportation and housing. So there are two documents where she signed and clearly understood. I know that Fadika is on the phone, and I wanted, she is our clinical placement faculty member. And Fadika, could you speak to Ms. Murphy's consideration that?
And members of the institution, please use the initials for the student.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was not. Okay, SM. I'm sorry. My apologies, SM. Fadika, would you please speak to during orientation and faculty hours, how you addressed with this class of 25, the clinical placements?
Yes. Thank you, everyone. My name is Fadika Okilola. I am the Director of Clinical Education for the program. It was clearly stated, starting from matriculation week, that attempts will be made to find clinical rotations in your area. However, our main hubs for rotations are in Arizona and Texas. Currently, we have a class already in clinical rotations, and some of those students were indeed able to find some rotations in their area, but for the bulk of the majority, everyone comes to either Texas and Arizona. This was clearly stated during the first week of matriculation, and also we tend to meet periodically. And I think it was once a month until we kind of dwindled it down a little bit. And every time during that meeting, during our faculty hour, whenever I'm being asked to call upon to just give clinical updates, and that was what I was told those students. Yeah, and you are not permitted, students in our program are not permitted to seek their own rotations. However, there's an opportunity given to the class. If you want to send in referrals, yes, you're welcome to, because we do know that students in other states, they do not plan on staying permanently in Arizona or Texas. So for them to be able to maybe partner with potential employers in their area, we did welcome that. Some students took advantage of that, and that is why in the class of 24 right now, some students are actually able to have rotations in their area. However, nothing is ever guaranteed because there are lots of red tapes in securing rotations, and this was clearly stated to the entire class.
Dr. Leck?
So I have a lot of experience with clinical placements for a lot of different colleges with different types of programs, and so I have some just kind of basic questions. I understand SM's perspective, and I understand the institutions because I understand how they interact. But what I'm not understanding is when this kind of came to light and the student believed one thing, did you attempt to find the clinical locations where they live? I understand they're not guaranteed, but now you know you have a problem. Did you guys try to work on that? And if you did, what were the issues for having clinical placements in that particular state, if there were? Like, what is the problem with now attempting to resolve the issue that way?
So for SM, she is a part of class of 25. When she matriculated, that was actually around the time where the class of 24 was about to go on clinical rotations. And so by default, class of 24 were priority. The plan was, okay, we still have time to onboard class of 25 because class of 25 will be starting their clinical rotations in September of this year. The plan was, let's onboard the class of 24, and if you do have referrals, send them in so that by the time class of 24 is fully onboarded, then we can start exploring what options we have for the class of 25. And that information was clearly communicated to the class multiple times. And some students took advantage of it. We are actually starting to work on those referrals now and offer services in terms of clinical rotation placement for the class of 25. We just started doing that. So last year was a little too early because we had another cohort ahead of this SM.
Okay, and I can understand that. But if you already knew this was a problem, did you ask SM to provide the list of their, you know, any of the recommendations that they had at that point in time? Because it sounds like something broke where it wasn't kind of like a hold on or, you know, we're going to work together, we're going to work this out. It kind of felt, it seems from me like there's a clear cut difference in position versus a work together to figure it out kind of thing.
This information was clearly communicated to the entire class. Students were open. What I told the student repeatedly was that, number one, you are not permitted to seek your own site by yourself because that's a clear violation of our accrediting body. Now you can send in referrals and that will be explored in due time. To the best of my knowledge, Ms. SM never sent in one referral.
Okay, I have another question, real quick, so I understand. How are your classes offered? Are they offered one at a time, like 8-week courses, one at a time? Are they offered in semesters? Like, what does that look like?
We offer multiple classes simultaneously, and it's per term.
So we offer up to eight classes.
I'm sorry, ma'am?
Are you by semester? Is it a semester? So was your semester August to December, and she withdrew in November? Is that what...
We are by term.
Okay, when does the term end? When does the term that she started in August, when does it end?
It ends in December.
Okay.
I can't recall the exact date, maybe December 15th-ish, but it ends in December.
Okay, I think you're a semester term. Okay, so SM, so then can I go back to SM, Kevin? I'm not trying to violate anything, or no?
We're done with SM, the communications, so I can ask guidance from our Assistant Attorney General if we have the ability to go back and ask a question of SM.
Yeah. That would be within your discretion. I think that this is a fact-finding tool that the committee has. I would suggest that it be allowed.
Okay. Thank you. So, Dr. Leahy, you want to hear from SM regarding that now?
Yes, I would like SM to specifically answer the question of whether you have a list of requested sites and you submitted those.
What they have not told you is that the only way that I could submit a referral is if I had an agreement from the preceptor before I entered school. I was not allowed to contact any after I went to school. So I did not have any because I was never told that I have to have them before I enter school. It was my understanding because of all the advertisements that they would make every effort to find them for me. And then after I got in school, as she just stated, I was not permitted to contact anyone. So I could not get any. I was never told before I went to school, I have to have them before and then after. She said I wasn't allowed to contact anyone to get them because I would have. I would have tried and found some. There are even services that you can pay to find them for you, but she said I was not allowed. I specifically emailed and asked her, can I find them? And she said no.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So those are my questions for now, Kevin, Molly, Noodle.
Dr. Boutte?
Yeah, I have a little bit of a follow-up in that. I think my first question to the school is twofold, really, is are the advertisement talks about the efforts that we made in order to find location near the student's home. I'm curious what efforts were made, and are the efforts being made contingent upon the student providing referrals? Or as an institution, you're seeing people coming in through admissions in different areas. Is there any way that you know those are coming in so you can proactively seek those sites?
We never tell our students upon matriculation that they have to have their own preceptors. It's a clear violation of our accrediting body. So that information was never shared with any student prior to matriculation. The information given to the entire class is that we as a school, we are responsible for assigning you rotation spots, and our rotation hubs are in Arizona or Texas. However, we welcome referrals. If you have referrals and we give them specific requirements, get us the name of the practice, the name of the doctor, their preferred contact, either a phone number or email, and we will take it up. You are not to go seek your own preceptor, for lack of a better word. Because some schools do permit that. PA schools generally do not. At a point, Ms. SM, she did reach out saying that she was able to get some service that was going to charge maybe like $12, $15 or something per hour. And she wanted school to be responsible for that. And I clearly responded saying that you are not permitted to handle this by yourself. It's a clear violation. However, if you have preceptors that you want us to explore, we will explore it. If it pans out and it works out in your favor, then you get this site when you get to your clinical year.
So I appreciate that. Maybe I didn't ask my question clearly. I'm asking what efforts were made on behalf of the institution to find a spot in Indianapolis, in that location, and what triggers need to happen in order for someone, is that based only on the student saying, here, I found some places, or is there communication as students are coming in, admissions knows where people are, that education in your department is looking for those, based on the statement in that one advertisement says every effort will be made to find something local to your home.
So the plan was to focus more on the current class that was getting into clinical year. And the plan was to delay any effort that we will have to put out for the class of 25 when we get into this year. When SM submitted all, when she started reaching out, we still had a whole cohort ahead of her. They were priority by the rule. And so the focus was on them. When they got onboarded, then the focus would now start being on the class of 25. And that was the plan. And that's still the plan right now.
Okay, so that what I'm hearing is that those efforts hadn't been made yet. It wasn't part of the plan for them to be made at this time.
Correct. At that time, yes.
Okay. And that's the follow-up question I have to that is, it's clearly written in SM's entrance essay that moving would not be a viable option. I'm curious about who reads those and if there's any communication back to SM on that point.
My understanding, anytime we offer admission to students, we have them sign a couple of documents. One of the documents is also about the clinical year, about relocation and where our hubs are. And if for some reason a student doesn't catch that information at that time, the moment they matriculate, we also let them know. Because we've had a little bit of a concern from the class of 24, which we were able to actually learn from on what to do and what not to do. And so we made certain adjustments. So every information regarding the clinical year was clearly stated from the very beginning. And students were very well aware of this.
Okay, thank you. Those are my questions for now.
Can you answer the question? Who reads those letters?
Melinda, can you answer that question? Who does the application review? Melinda's our new program director.
So I apologize, I'm coming late into this discussion having some internet challenges, but as I understand it, the question is who reads those admissions or interview Word documents?
Mr. Romano is having some vocal challenges. So the question is, it's clearly stated in SM's entrance essay that moving for the clinical is not an option. And my curiosity is who reads those and who would have reached out having read it to say, wow, maybe this isn't a fit.
So that is actually not part of our admissions packet. So when the students are asked to do that writing, it is reviewed for their ability to write, not the content of the letter. So it is read by the individuals that did her interview on the day that she interview with Franklin Pierce, and I believe that was in spring of 2023. We do not make assumptions that students' circumstances will remain the same or change. They need to tell us if their circumstances remain or change. So that was not read for part of the admissions process as her statement and desire to enter the program. It was read for technical ability and writing ability.
Dr. Leck, I see your hand.
The challenge that I'm having in my brain is, from what I hear from the school, the student had expressed a concern. So they were upfront in that writing, right? They expressed a concern about a placement. The communication that you guys are you're saying right now is that the other students were a priority because they were going to hit the clinical portion first, which I totally get. But now what I feel like is you're asking that student then to wait a year and keep continuing into the program with without like some kind of agreement or assurance or something that this will be resolved, right? It's almost just like a hold on, we'll get to you. Like, they're supposed to keep going. And I think she's reacting to, you know, the potential of I'm going to spend, what, another semester, you know, in this program, and I might not, and I'm not going to know that I'm going to be able to stay in their area. And it just, it seems a little combative. I mean, I get the school's issues. I totally do, right? All day long, get this. But I think where this went wrong, in my opinion, is it doesn't seem like you guys are trying to figure out how to approach this, and because you have a chicken and the egg problem. You're saying you can't submit any, you can't help find your placement, but you can submit referrals. And I don't understand how they're supposed to do that if they're not allowed to talk to anybody and say, hey, I'm interested, would you possibly take some, so they can refer them to you. Like, I don't understand how this is supposed to work. It doesn't make sense to me.
May I address that?
Yes.
Please.
Thank you. So members of the council, our challenges are that ARCPA is our accrediting body. It very specifically says that students cannot be required to go find their own clinical rotations. So we must, you know, work within those parameters. What we do is allow students, as Professor Okilola has mentioned, to make reference to providers that they feel would be open to taking students. So they are, in some PA programs, allowed to give those referrals. In other PA programs, they do not have students make referrals. In our program, we were open to students making those referrals. However, those referrals are not asked for until, so we are on terms. We are on 12-week terms, just to clarify that. So at the start of SM's term, she made it through one term, which ended November, December-ish, fall of last year. I don't know the specific dates. I apologize. We do not ask for those referrals to start working on them until second term. So the challenge in life, as Professor Okilola stated, is that our focus always has to be, as with any PA program, not just ours, on the students that are currently out in clinical rotation. What I think is lacking expression here is that our first class going out on clinical rotation did not start until what would have been the first week of term two for SM. So quite literally, our students in our first cohort going out into clinical rotations were starting that week. So she actually withdrew, SM actually withdrew, prior to opening of the referral process. So she never gave us any referrals. It's not to say that we would not have worked on them or that we would not have made our best effort. It's that we literally were not into the process at that point when we start accepting referrals. ARC-PA, our certifying body that says we can be a PA program, says that we must find student rotations. They do not quantify that they need to be near a student's home, that they be a site that the student approves of. It is at the program's discretion to make sure that it is an appropriate site and the students are getting a quality education in the breadth and width that they need in order to become qualified PAs. So part of our challenge is that we did not have an opportunity to gain those referrals from her or ever work on them because we were not to the point where we would start accepting them. And it was the same way with the class that is out now on clinical rotations. They did not give them from the word go or from the start of their very first term. Those referrals were not made till later in the process. So that process in most situations is a luxury for PA programs, not a right of the students because it's not required by ARC that we accept referrals from students to find them. However, we are trying to work with our students to make that the best process possible.
So I find that quite interesting because, you know, in experience with nursing, right, the predators are saying that because they don't want institutions to put the complete onus of finding clinical locations on the students, right? Otherwise, they get handicapped and they're sitting out there in the world by themselves. I have never understood it to be that, you know, that they don't get to participate in the process and say, hey, I have found three, and then the school has to evaluate those to determine whether or not they meet your accrediting requirements and all your curricular requirements. And that is completely, I just never heard of it the way you guys are presenting it. And so I kind of feel like it's, it should be way more collaborative than this is coming across. The other thing is, I swear I heard during the conversation, is that the student either believes that they were supposed to submit these up front because Fidike, please excuse me if I don't mean to mess with you, but if she indicated that they were to do that prior to enroll, like there's something here where I just thought I heard that it was for enrollment, and now I'm hearing it's not until the middle.
Mm-mm. We're not able to accept those from students in advance of matriculation because if they don't matriculate, there's no process to be potentially had there. Programs do not ask students for pre-matriculation referrals. I think what she may be referring to, and I do not want to put words in her mouth, but I think what she may be referring to is before matriculation, students believe that they can go out and recruit sites, trying to find their own sites. That is never acceptable according to ARC-PA. They cannot be required to find their own sites. We're not saying that they cannot go out and talk to people and say, do you take students? But there's a very fine line that programs walk between students appearing as if they are required to find their own sites versus having a conversation with somebody about would you be interested. Then the onus is on the program to take that referral and pursue it.
100%. And that's how I would understand it. And so I feel like if that had kind of gone, like this could have been calmed a little bit. You know what I mean? Like I guess my question is, are you guys even at this point, if the student was enrolled, let's just pretend, if the student was enrolled, would you guys be finding that student a site in Indianapolis based on the fact that they've disclosed that they couldn't, you accepted them as a student? Is that even a possibility?
I don't know that I can say yes or say no because you're asking a hypothetical. And in this situation, I have 47 other students matriculating with her class that are not under the same precept that she is. So I can't.
Okay, let me ask you this question. Do you have any current students that are currently in Indianapolis?
I don't know.
Okay. I'll defer.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Luck. Mr. Romano, do you want to ask your questions? Mr. Romano,
First, I want to thank the school for acknowledging the advertising was unclear, and that is the reason the school changed it. To verify, the school has a total of 4 locations, 1 in Goodyear and 3 other in New Hampshire. Is that correct?
So we have 1 location in Renge, New Hampshire. We have an MPAS program in Lebanon that is not a hybrid program. And we have a hybrid program in Arizona and 1 in Texas that just had its first matriculating class with this term.
How many students does the school have that are outside of Goodyear, Arizona and the New Hampshire locations?
Trying to answer that question because we also have physician, we also have physical therapy programs. So Melinda, there are 24 in the class of 24 and 48 in the class of 25. Am I correct?
No, ma'am. There's 43 in the class of 2024, and I'm not sure what the percentage is that are physically claiming a domicile in Arizona, and class of 2025 is 48 in same answer.
And that includes the question was also in Texas. How many of these students have come from Indiana over the past few years, roughly?
I don't think we know that answer to give you a head count. The hybrid program is only in its 2nd year in Arizona. Is that correct, Melinda?
That is correct. So we only have class of 24 and class of 25, which SM was a part of 25.
Next question. How many clinical site agreements does the school have outside of Goodyear and the New Hampshire locations, or has it had?
I'm not sure if I can give a rough number, but I can briefly tell you that we have multiple sites out of Arizona and Texas. We have some sites in Washington State. We have some sites in California, in Florida, in New York, in Utah. So we do have some sites here and there, but most of our sites are in Texas and Arizona.
How many within the state of Indiana?
As of today, none. Because we have no prior student from Indiana State.
From Mr. Romano, how broad is the marketing for the school, and how many states outside of Arizona and Texas does the school enroll from?
Melinda, do you have the enrollment, because I know there's for Arizona and Texas that students are from all over the country. I don't know to what.
I will say looking at the class of 24, a bulk majority of our students are from Arizona. We have just a handful in Texas. However, other students are from California, Florida, Utah, Kansas, and Washington State. In the class of 25 now, which SM would have been a part of, we still have a bulk of our students from Arizona, and we do have another batch from California, Texas, Florida, and Washington State. Then we have maybe 1 or 2 students in Michigan, Louisiana, Connecticut, Colorado, so basically all over the country. But she happens to be the only one from Indiana.
So it sounds like clinicals are available in 5 states or so.
While our focus is in Arizona and Texas, at least that's how we were able to get accreditation, what we started doing is if we have more than five students in a state, we try to also pursue additional preceptors in that area so that students can have the opportunity to rotate or work with providers in that area before they come over to one of our hubs. So yes, we do have hubs, a little bit of hubs outside of Texas and Arizona.
And where is that disclosed in the materials?
It is not disclosed anywhere now.
What we say is that students do not have to move because it's a hybrid program in their first year. That's very clear, and that clinical rotations are where we are able to find them. So we don't make a commitment to the second year clinical rotations not equaling movement. And that's why when I read you her acceptance in her student handbook, it was very clear about clinical placements. So, and her signing that, there was no disclaimer. She didn't sign it saying, and mark that saying that's a problem at the time that she accepted enrollment or when a few months later when she signed the student handbook. So at that point, she understood the piece about clinical couldn't be guaranteed in Indiana. I know she wanted it to be, but I, as Dr. Owe said, is that we have the ability to guarantee hubs in Arizona and Texas, and that she has worked hard to get clinical placements elsewhere, but the hubs still remain in Arizona and Texas because we don't want our students moving around the country because that is a hardship. Am I saying that correctly, Melinda?
Yes, the challenges of being a new program is that it takes time to develop, you know, an extensive, let's call it bank of preceptors. So as the continuation of the program, or as we continue to move forward, we will add more clinical sites. And again, as Professor Okilola mentioned, it may be in different hubs, and we are trying to do our best to expand. However, at this point, Arizona and Texas was where we start out. We are hoping that students understand that as we continue to get referrals, we will continue to expand. However, we can, again, not make those guarantees and that they would be specifically near the student's home.
Another question for Mr. Romano. Coming back to the review of the sample letter, who again reads that? Admissions?
Admissions does not. It's the individuals that do the interview on the day that the student is offered her interview. And again, that is read for technical writing skills, not for content.
Who does the interview?
It can be any one of a multitude of people. So it could be faculty, it could be staff, it could be an adjunct or a guest lecturer.
You're good. Mr. Roman, are you're done? All right, we'll move on to next was Dr. Boutte. You had your hand.
Yes, thank you. Can you help me understand the reason that the institution chose to change the advertising that we can see copies of in the complaint that speak to student will be able to engage in their clinical close to home, quote, that their clinical training within their own local communities will happen, that every effort will be made for those to be present in their sites and they don't have to put their life on pause and move. Just like to hear a little about why those were changed or removed.
So I cannot speak to those. Those advertisements were done prior to my joining the faculty. with the program, and my tenure as program director has only been for the last 30 days. So I'm sorry I cannot speak to that. Gwen, can you speak to that?
Well, we had, I should, I'm sorry, we had a change of program directors here in February, but that social media was actually student social media and not university approved social media. So we wanted to make sure that we were reflecting really what we were able to do, which is the hubs in Arizona and Texas. It wasn't at all an attempt to deliberately mislead students, but rather to clarify in our more current and reaching out to prospective students. And again, you know, the social media that she refers to, Facebook and Instagram, were done in May of 2023, after she'd already signed her enrollment agreement. And the press release was from 22. So, and that the person who made that is no longer with the university.
Yet at the time, it was reflective of the university. And the other two pieces are actually on your website. They weren't social media. I'm just curious about what the thought was behind removing them, and if there's been any seek to understand the impact of that advertising on potential students.
I can't say that the verbiage, part of the challenges is the verbiage. There's a, you know, when we're saying that students can stay in their area, that's quite different than promising we will be able to find them. So can, meaning that if we can find them clinical rotation sites near their home, absolutely, we want to try and work with students to do so.
Go ahead, Dr. I just want to make sure, are you through with questioning, or?
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll move on. Dr. Leck?
Can you help me understand how your clinicals work? Are they throughout an entire term and they have to do, you know, full-time clinical work, or what is it? What's the clinical schedule?
It's every 5 weeks and it's full-time. So they can be in, for example, maybe internal medicine for 5 weeks in Arizona, maybe in one city in Arizona, and the next 5 weeks they have to up and go to maybe another city within Arizona for family medicine. So it's every 5 weeks, and it's full-time.
For two rotations, or is there more?
We have a total of 9 rotations.
Holy moly. Okay. All right, so... Well, that is a huge commitment, even for your students that live in Arizona to have to go. Wow. Okay, I'm going to defer because that's blown my mind. Wow.
That's an RPA requirement that they have those rotations. They're very specific: family medicine, internal medicine, women's health, pediatrics, surgery. So that's actually not dictated by us. That's dictated by the RPA, which is our accrediting body.
No, and I completely understand that. That's not it. I mean, you know, if you want to be a nurse, I get that, right? You know, they have all the clinical rotations in that too. But the challenge that I'm having is, you know, just really thinking about it. In order to be able to serve your population, you'd have to be in some kind of metropolis area where they, you know, you could find all 9 of those. And that's what. So what you're saying is, in Washington, you found a student those 9 separate things in their area, and in California you found those 9 things, so they were able to stay in their city?
No. Since our hubs right now are mainly in Arizona and Texas, we have all those 9 locations in those states. Outside of those areas, because we're a new program, we're also trying to partner with preceptors in other areas, especially if we have more than 5 students there. So in a state like Washington, we have 2 sites right now there. In California also, we have 2 sites right now. So hopefully as we go on, we can have more sites But students in those areas, we have those two rotations that we have within that state, if they happen to be either in Washington State or California, before they have to either come to Arizona or Texas.
Yeah. Okay. That's helpful.
Dr. Leck, any additional questions? Dr. Boutte, any additional questions?
No, not at this time.
Okay. And Mr. Romano, I received your information about a motion. So at this point, we'll close conversation and discussion on this matter. There has been a motion made by Mr. Romano, of which I will read. From Mr. Romano, I move that unless this matter is resolved between the school and the student prior to our next board meeting, we elevate this matter for full board review based upon what appears to be a past general statements of local clinicals in areas that they are enrolling from or could enroll from that possibly have never had clinicals available. The use of general statements of local clinicals when it would seem the far majority of the clinicals are isolated to their school locations and or one or two other states may cause confusion for consumers outside the two school locations. It would seem the school had has an opportunity to better disclose this fact to all students outside the two primary areas beyond a general disclaimer of may, when in reality, it would be more accurate to state something different that actually represents their footprint of clinical availability. In preparation of this meeting, I would ask that the school provide any documentation of all locations outside of Goodyear and New Hampshire locations where they have provided clinicals. This should include location names, contact information, and dates the clinicals were available to students. An analysis of the percentage of students outside Arizona and New Hampshire who have had to relocate for clinicals would also be helpful. Although we are limited in what we can do for students in these situations, I would also request that we understand any of the costs collected by the school from the student during the period of enrollment related to fees and tuition. And that would be Mr. Romano's motion. Do I have a second?
I'll second. This is Dr. Leck.
Dr. Leck, a second. Any additional conversation between the board members? Hearing none, we will move to a vote. So I have a motion from Mr. Romano. Do we have a second?
That was Dr. Leck.
Dr. Leck, a second. The vote, Mr. Romano? Mr. Romano votes aye. Dr. Leck?
Aye.
Dr. Leck votes aye. Dr. Boutte?
Aye.
Dr. Boutte votes aye. We will send some information to the institution regarding the upcoming board meeting, which will be in April. And we will look forward to your response. Mr. Blanchard?
Yes, thank you, Mr. LaMountain. So in the motion, it says if there is no resolution. So two things, considering what a resolution would either be re-enrolling her and finding her a clinical somewhere or a refund. And if there is a resolution, are you no longer gonna review this at the state board level? Pursuant to the motion, just want to make I get a clarification so I know what to do on staff's end. Thank you.
Mr. Romano states, I would see a resolution that both parties agree. Okay.
And if there is one, then it will not go in front of the board. It'll just be dismissed. It'll have to go in front of the board for dismissal. Board staff can't dismiss it, so it'll have to at least
go before the board.
So it'll be on the agenda as a board, and then if it's done, you can just tell them that it's been taken care of. And you still want the other documentation that you're requesting at that point, if it is resolved?
If it is not resolved.
Understood. Thank you so much, Mr. Romano. I appreciate that.
All right. Thank you. You will receive some information from board staff regarding next steps. Next up, Indian Bible College with a complaint in JG. Mr. Blanchard.
Thank you, Mr. LaMountain. Board Chair, members of the Complaint Committee. Complaint in JG, I guess I'll try to put that there's a lot of history of communication between Indian Bible College and JG in reference to his enrollment time at the university. He is currently enrolled in an associate's program. He was in the housing, apparently the housing policies, which are part of the complaint responses and documentation, are for full-time students. He did have to move at some point. There's been a lot of communication between JG and the institution. I'm going to list kind of what the allegations are. His feelings are a lot of the policies are informal and ambiguous. They don't follow the housing policy. The approval to return in reference to his next program, actually, that's from a different thing, so I apologize for that part. So he wasn't terminated. He's an associate in the biblical studies. His original enrollment was in full time, which was in June 6th of 2023. He went to part time after that in an associate's program. If you have any questions, JG is present. I believe Emily Green, CFO, is present. Dr. Copen, the president of the university, is present, and it looks like there's some other individuals also there, but I don't know who they are.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Blanchard. As a reminder to both JG and the institution, that the board committee has reviewed all of the materials that you have provided, so we are looking for a very brief initial statement, and then question and answer will follow. We'll start with JG. For any additional comments or brief statement. And JG, you are on mute.
Can you hear me?
We can, yes.
All right, sorry about that. I'm going to read the statement. I'm going to rush a little because the letter I got said 5 minutes. So last semester, I wrote a grievance against my university for retaliation and intimidation. I was kicked off campus 8 weeks later, having never broken a rule at the institution. Though I've been accused of misconduct, and there's been no due process as outlined in the college's student handbook and catalog. The accusations are false. There never was an oral warning given as per their own rules. No violation occurred. My status is one of a good student with a 4.0 GPA and perfect attendance. I participate in all the required programs. I treat the instructors, students, and staff the way I would want to be treated. The grievance was written at the beginning of last semester after I left a meeting with the Dean of Med, Josh Manning. During the meeting, I asked him why I had been overlooked for a room that opened up. A new student had been placed in the room. Part of my summer had been spent sleeping on the floor in the dorm because no bed was provided, even though I asked repeatedly. He immediately lost his temper and told me that I did not get the room because I was a whiny complainer, that's a quote, and that things were going to be rough for me moving forward. I thanked him and left the office. I understood that I was being retaliated against for complaining during the previous school year. I had not spoken to the dean for a man, Josh Manning, in months. He had been on sabbatical for the summer. Life on campus during that break had been a mixture, during the summer had been a mixture of work, vacation, Bible school, and trying to get a bed. There had been one odd incident regarding the college president contacting me to repeat a minor check-in that I had already completed. But that didn't seem to involve the Dean of Men. During the preceding months, there had been other things that concerned me because I felt they were intentionally signaling that I was unwelcome. For instance, when I started my attendance at IBC, I was giving the rules and regulations, the guidelines. According to the handbook, new students are required to attend 3 meetings at the Soma Church that is run by members of the administration and students of IBC. It's a home church called SOMA, S-O-M-A. My daughter is a teenager, and she would hang out with the children of IBC members during the required meetings. Later on, when I noticed the same group of kids participated in the evening events on campus, I asked the student that worked with the kids to contact me about when the events took place so that my child could be there. I asked on two occasions, no response. I then asked Josh Manning to let me know when the SOMA kids would be on campus. He told me my child was ineligible because she attended youth group at my church. When I submitted my grievance, I tried to resolve it in-house at IBC. At first, I was told by the president, Jason Coppin, and vice president, Lucky Bigman, that my daughter was welcome at the SOMA events and that it had all been a misunderstanding. But no one has ever notified me of any future events, and they seem to have stopped. Since then, President Coffin has indicated that SOMA, though per the 23-24 University Handbook, page 16, students are required to attend those three meetings. He told me that SOMA has nothing to do with the school, so I cannot have a grievance about it. As I stated, my grievance is for intimidation and retaliation. I send information about specific events and am ready to answer questions. My hopeful resolutions are that I receive due process when I'm accused. I've asked IBC, where are reports of wrongdoing? When was I informed about infractions or interviewed per their own guidelines? That's the process. Also, my daughter should not be excluded from the youth events. Concerning my housing eligibility problem, that developed after I filed the grievance. I registered full-time before the beginning of the semester. My schedule was altered without my permission, and I was kicked off campus. That is unfair. I've always obeyed dorm rules. There is not a semester where I was not the most responsible student, being the oldest. Regarding cleanliness and morale, my dorm resident advisor at the time of my removal was PP. His phone number is on record. Let me close by stating that I am not the only student that I have directly witnessed receiving unfair treatment. A year ago, Marin Billigoti was, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to use his name, MB, was pushed off campus in one day. He was a student who obeyed the rules. They called him a violator, but he was given no due process as outlined in their own rule book that he could defend, so he could defend himself. He wasn't given that opportunity. It is similar to what is happening to me. If the school would use their own guidelines, it would limit them to fairness. They prefer to operate on an invisible system utilizing subjectivity and ambiguity. Nothing is written down. It gives them freedom to manhandle the student. If they have additional standards, post them. If a fundraiser or a taco sale is desired, schedule it, get a permit, document it that it ever existed so that I can give the IRS and the Department of Labor my volunteer hours. Indian Bible College is an accredited university. They have rules as well as the student. It is my request that they submit to them. Thanks for my time.
Thank you, JG. Board members, any questions for the complainant, JG? Seeing none. We will move on for a representative from Indian Bible College. Could you address the committee, provide your name?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. O'Malley. I couldn't type fast enough. JG, can you clarify the change in your full-time to part-time schedule?
Yeah, I never said that I wanted to be part-time. What happened was is when they decided to kick me out of the school, they said, we're going to let you get your finish your degree. Your hours are going to be changed to, this was November. They said your hours are going to be changed to part-time, so you can do that. And because you're part-time now that we've decided to do that, you're ineligible to live in the housing, so you need to find your own place. Is that what you're asking?
It is. Thank you.
Any additional questions then for JG? Again, hearing none, let's move on to Indian Bible College, and whoever is going to be representing the college, please introduce yourself.
Yeah, good afternoon. I'm Dr. Jason Coffin, the president of Indian Bible College, here with the president's cabinet, vice presidents, and then our compliance officer and CFO. This situation has actually been followed according to policy. The enrollment agreement says that a student cannot remain if they're disruptive within the student body. The student handbook says a student can be summarily dismissed for disrespectful for disrespect to staff or faculty, actually allowing this student to finish the associates is more merciful than that. There, we have a documented record of the oral warnings, repeated oral warnings, and then a written warning, according to policy, that were followed. The college had complete grounds to dismiss this student summarily and not even let him finish any part of his enrollment, but out of a desire to accommodate and be as merciful as possible, we've allowed him to finish his associates. So thank you for your consideration. This is a situation that is definitely a challenge for us. It's our first time we're dealing with a student complaint, and I appreciate the committee's attention to matters.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Coffman. Members of the committee, questions for the institution? From Mr. Romano, can you speak to changing the student from full-time to part-time?
Yeah, this student started, it was a spring semester start, and so only needed part-time credits to finish the associates. To remain full-time would have been actually entering into the bachelor's part of the program, which is not acceptable. Allowing the student to finish part-time was that act of mercy instead of dismissing them immediately because of the disruptive and disrespectful behavior.
Next question from Mr. Romano. It seems as though the student is able to complete their associate program, but is being denied admission to the bachelor's program. What are the requirements of admissions to the bachelor's program?
So the bachelor's program is a continuation for many students of the associates, but in situations like these, when there's behavioral problems, and we are a very small residential campus, 25 to 30 students, and so disruptive, disrespectful behavior has a tremendously harmful effect upon the student body, upon the campus. And so the bachelor's program is designed for leadership training. The associates is designed for service orientation. And we felt like the most we could do for the student with their behavior was to allow them to continue. Again, did not need to allow them to continue based upon the documented pattern of behavior, but allow them to continue the associates into completion. I could read the course objectives of programmatic objectives of the bachelor's program if that would be helpful. But
from Mr. Romano, but you didn't terminate the student. If you didn't terminate, you denied approval outside your process.
We didn't terminate, right? Correct. We allowed him to complete.
Yeah, functionally, the student will be terminated after the completion of the associate program. It's a future termination.
That's not a termination.
Okay, understood.
From Mr. Romano, so how can you deny enrollment into the BA program?
The enrollment agreement that the student signed committed, understood that they, the termination or enrollment could be terminated if they disrupt the normal activities of the school. The student handbook it acknowledges the possibility of immediate dismissal for for disrespect for staff or faculty. We believed we were going above and beyond in not immediately terminating or dismissing the student by allowing them to finish the associates. What I'm hearing the committee say is that we actually should have terminated, or at least one of the scenarios would dismiss or terminate immediately, rather than allowing the completion of the associates. And we discussed that possibility, but out of consideration and mercy for the student, decided to delay that.
Follow-up question from Mr. Romano, but he wasn't dismissed or terminated.
Correct.
From Mr. Romano, which it makes it very ambiguous. Okay, Mr. Romano has completed his questions. Dr. Boutte?
I'm just looking for some clarity. I've been reviewing the documents. It appears like there's two enrollment agreements. Can you help me understand what is program CBS 2019 and what is program ABS 2019?
Sure. So when students first enroll at IBC, they start with the Certificate of Biblical Studies program. Our programs are progressive. So upon completion or almost to completion of that one, they have the opportunity to continue on with the associates. And then towards the end of that, they may continue on to the bachelor's. So each time they enroll in a new program along this progressive degree program, they sign a new enrollment agreement.
Okay, so that's where I'm seeing the CBS is the initial certificate, the ABS is the associates.
Correct.
I understand. And is there an enrollment into the bachelor's, an enrollment agreement to move into the bachelor's?
There is, unless a student is not allowed to continue on.
Did JG sign an enrollment agreement to move into a bachelor's that was not provided us in exhibits?
No, he did not.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Boutte. Dr. Leck?
I just have a quick question. I am believing that I'm understanding from the institution that it is your desire not to have the student at the institution. Just because of the questions about the bachelor's, I'm trying to understand, is it the student's intention to want to even pursue into the bachelor's, or are they just, you know, wanting to air their grievance against the school for their perception of treatment?
Is that a question for me?
Yeah, Dr. Leff, who's the question for?
It would be for JG, I guess, if he's the only one that can answer it. I didn't know if anyone else understood that part.
Yeah, when I entered the college, during the winter, and so I didn't know that would make it, the associate would last for 5 semesters. I didn't understand that. And so they explained how it works, and I trusted that. I told them I ultimately wanted to be a pastor and wanted to get that degree. So the bachelor's, they told me the way we do it is this, I guess, step by step. First, they sign you up for the certificate program, then the associates, and then you keep working towards. Other than that, they asked me a couple of times, you know, what's your intention? And I said to finish with the BS.
Have you attended a different school now already? Are you enrolled somewhere else?
I'm still in Indian Bible College. The thing is, I filed the grievance, and it's my contention, this is my feeling, that more retaliation happened because I was kicked off campus and told that my enrollment would be terminated at the end of the associate's degree. So I'm taking classes. They wouldn't, I did register full time, but they rejected that. They gave me their own registration, which limits me to just the classes to get the associate's degree. And then I'm gone. Then I have to go.
Thank you.
All right. Dr. Leck, any additional questions? Dr. Boutte?
Yeah, I'd like to follow up on that because now I'm confused about something. My understanding was that the schedule was reduced in order for JG to complete the associates. However, JG was also never signed up to take the bachelor's. So now I'm curious what was on JG's schedule that was reduced. The implication is that they were classes for the bachelor's, and yet that was a program he was not enrolled in. So I'm confused how there was a reduction from full-time to part-time when there was no documented enrollment in the bachelor's and his full-time schedule should have only been associates. I'm confused on this point.
Correct. During course registration, our registrar made a mistake. She had missed the notification that only the associate's classes were available for the student. And we corrected that within, I think, 24, 48 hours. There was no financial penalties. There was no consequences for JG in that. It was simply a miscommunication.
So is that miscommunication on the part of the registrar enrolling into those classes and then de-enrolling them? Is that what moved JG from full-time to part-time?
The intention all the way back to the notification of this decision as of November 1st was to keep JG part-time in the spring. JG knew this. JG attempted to still enroll for the full-time classes, and our registrar made a mistake, which we corrected within, I think, 24, 48 hours.
Okay. I don't want to belabor this. I'm still struggling to understand. So the full-time schedule included bachelor's classes or did not include bachelor's classes?
Well, the initial registration included bachelor's classes, which JG never started. This was a registration before the semester started, before classes began, and then was removed to part-time for just the associate's classes.
So
before classes began.
In theory, if someone were only to go through the associates, would their last semester be part-time?
Possibly. That's unlikely if they are a fall semester start, but the way our courses are sequenced, it's very difficult to be a spring semester start and get it in just four semesters.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Can I add something?
Can you guys hear me? JG, hold on one moment. Dr. Boutte, any additional questions or follow-up?
No, that I think I understand a little better. Thank you.
Are we open to hearing a comment from JG?
I am. I don't know about others.
Okay. So, JG, did you have a brief comment?
Yeah, to be clear, so my intention was to get the bachelor's degree. I was never given the opportunity to sign up for it. Like when I first enrolled, I was told and I trusted that they kind of stair-step it. And so I would enroll in classes every semester. And so the reason that I signed up for the full registration, which was rejected, is because yes, they told me that that the classes were going to be reduced without my permission, but referencing the student that had been kicked out last year, you know, the narrative became that it was his idea. So I wanted to make sure that they understood that that was their idea, not mine. My intention has always been to keep going till I got the bachelor's degree. So that's what I wanted, and they signed me up for the first certificate, then the associate's degree. That's the way that it went. That's the way I understood it was supposed to go.
Thank you. I know Mr. Romano has a chat question. I just have a direct follow-up from that to the institution. At what point in the typical student's schedule moving from the associates to the bachelor's, maybe based on semester, would they have then signed an enrollment agreement to continue to the bachelor's?
I see the CPS was signed in January, it looks like, and the ABS was signed in August. At what point would JG have typically signed to move into the bachelor's?
Yeah, that would normally be done prior to the beginning of those classes. When in a situation like this, where you had part-time completion of one program and then moving into the subsequent one, that's when the enrollment agreement would typically be put before a student in good standing.
Typically before the last semester of the associates? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Mr. Romano has a chat question.
Great. Yes, Mr. Romano's question. Again, what are the specific admissions requirements to enter the school?
The process for admission and applicant standards are in the catalog on pages 14 and 15. They're spiritual standards, academic standards. And as the student mentioned, the academic standards aren't the problem, but the spiritual standards are. The behavior from the student has been toxic to his peers, and there are staff and students walking on eggshells around the student because of this pattern of disruptive and disrespectful behavior. So there is no option of this student continuing. And it was above and beyond our part allowing him even to remain to fulfill his associates, which I'm hearing may have been a mistake. The mistake on our part may have been not terminating him immediately. I don't know if that's what the board is recommending or suggesting, but that's possible.
Okay, a question from Mr. Romano. Does the school maintain a denial log of admissions to the respective programs?
We're a small enough school. We can produce a denial log, but don't have anything like that in documentation form right now. But that data is available through all the tracking and record keeping through IFEDS and registrar records and so on. And I can say that JG is not the first student that we've told you can finish the associates but not pursue the bachelor's.
From Mr. Romano, how are you able to demonstrate you are equitable in your process from one student to another?
Can you repeat the question? I'm going to ask one of our student deans to deal with that.
Certainly. This is from Mr. Romano. How are you able to demonstrate you are equitable in your process from one student to another?
I think it's clearly stated in the student handbook that the standards that we request from a student, students will normally declare which degree they're pursuing in the application. And because of the not just the academic standards, but the spiritual standards that are required from a student, we're able to determine if the student is ready for the bachelor's program. We're stating that they're ready for leadership, that they've not just demonstrated the academic side of it, but they've demonstrated and proven their leadership ability and fulfilling certain leadership roles progressively to attain the bachelor's degree.
From Mr. Romano, the statement is, I'm looking for consistency in your process.
Which process specifically? Can you clarify?
And his next statement was, again, it seems ambiguous. Denials, specifically related to denials.
Oh, denials.
Okay.
Thank you.
I speak? Just thinking about the student handbook, it introduces the handbook with three levels of standards. I believe it's institutional, community, and biblical standards, and we are a Bible institution, so there are at least those three levels that we do hold all students and staff, faculty to. And so we would say that would be our equitable, I believe, if this is answering your question, I'm understanding it, equitable denial or dismissal would be based on those three standards and everything that falls under those. And that's developed in the student handbook, the staff and faculty handbook, if I'm following. Yeah. Just trying to get maybe more concrete for you.
The next question from Mr. Romano, is there some type of grading scale or rubric that's documented?
For denial?
For denial specifically?
We are on the topic of denial.
So it would have to do with a student not being in good standing related to disruptive and disrespectful behavior. And many students struggle with this, but most students respond well to corrective action. This student has not. This student has accused us of targeting and misdoing and all kinds of horrible things when attempting corrective action that is documented in the repeated verbal warnings as per policy, and then a written warning as per policy that wasn't followed through on. So we could generate a document of those who have been allowed to continue versus those who haven't related to fulfillment and compliance of standards, but a student who remains in good standing has responded well to corrective action. This student has not. And we have that, and that's documented.
Okay. No further questions for Mr. Romano. Before I move on to Dr. Boutte, just an administrative piece. We will lose quorum at 3 p.m. today based upon Mr. Romano recusing himself from the last case and Dr. Leck moving to having a hard stop at 3 p.m. So I just wanted to provide that information to the committee. Dr. Boutte?
Yes, I think I was trying to track Mr. Romano's intention, and you know, I understand the catalog says one thing. It's about how can you show that you are equitably enforcing that which is in the catalog? And if there have been other people who have had to have these conversations in order to correct behavior, are those documented in the same way the ones that JG have been documented, so that it's easy to tell that your standards are being applied equitably?
Understood. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Any additional questions from the committee members? Hearing and seeing none, does a committee member have or would like to make a motion on this case? And Mr. Romano, are you making a motion? If you could just shake your head. Yes. Okay. Thank you. From Mr. Romano, I would make a motion. This also go to the main board for review and determination of the school's practices of denial to a program. That is the motion. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Dr. Boutte seconds. We have a motion and a second. Any discussion between committee members? Hearing none, the vote. Mr. Romano? Mr. Romano votes aye. Dr. Leck? Dr.
Aye.
Leck?
Aye.
Dr. Leck votes aye. Dr. Boutte?
Aye.
Dr. Boutte votes aye. By the vote of 3 ayes, no nays, that motion will pass. We will provide, staff will provide some additional information to the institution as we move towards our April board meeting, which you'll be required to attend. Okay. Thank you. The final case today is the 2023 PPE 0007 College versus complaint AM. Mr. Blanchard.
Mr. LaMountain, Mr. Chair, members of the complaint committee, I'll be real brief because I'm sure you'll have a lot of questions. AM was in the surgical tech program. He completed all his academic requirements and then was in his clinical. There were some concerns documented that are in the response and in the information that was submitted by AM. He reapplied as required. He was accepted back. He was supposed to start July of 2023. There was a reverse of the approval to start another clinical. I wanted the board to know that the previous dean, Nicole, and I hope I pronounced her name, Bisquet, who I did a skip trace and located her in Marana, I made numerous calls to speak to her regarding her review of this decision, which allegedly was overturned by a Benson Bradley, who was a regional dean of Adelaide Health. Here to answer your questions regarding all the documentation is AM, and for the institution, I believe Stephanie Nearing, the compliance coordinator, Steve Watkins, and in the email chain was Don Corbin. I never got a response as to who is going to appear, so I'm assuming he might be here as well.
I appreciate that, Mr. Blanchard. Before we move on, I did want to make an announcement that Mr. Romano is recusing himself from any vote on this particular issue. So that stated, I believe, is the complainant AM on the call?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, AM, if you, the committee has all the information that you provided and the school has provided. So if you could just make a brief statement.
Yes, it was overturned by Roberta Stanfield, actually. She's a certified medical assistant, I believe, and was part of the committee for the school. Benson Bradley just heard about the situation afterwards. I was in this clinical site where I worked for Banner Health, so I worked for the same facility and followed every policy available. At the beginning of my clinical site, Christy Potts, which is a clinical coordinator, she resigned the position, and she was also holding program director at the time. So we didn't have any accommodations for a clinical coordinator. I know the school advised that the campus of Tucson, I believe, was going to help, but we didn't receive any feedback or any help. I believe the clinical site was discouraged from not having any communication with the school. They were requesting information of what type of surgeries I would start with, and we couldn't get a hold of them. Afterwards, I was just submitting timesheets. In the meantime, I think it was directed to the dean because we had no one else. The accusations that I get were the lack of motivation, no call, no show, and failure to take direction. When they talk about the no call, no shows, I believe they talk about when I missed the clinical site for COVID testing. The OR manager was just concerned since there was a lot of infections, so she asked me to test for COVID twice with a period of 5 days in between. I did that, but I was also following policy for Banner Health, so I requested extra shifts with my director, and it was approved. I had no symptoms and a negative COVID test. And I believe I heard from colleagues that they had seen me in the cafeteria, so they were concerned I had no mask or spreading COVID or anything like that. So that's where that's at. With a lack of motivation, I still don't see it because every single day I had to speak to the charge nurse to be set in an OR. And in the first week, I was set in the schedule. Anything after that, I wasn't set. So every single day I was speaking to the OR charge nurse to be able to be set in the, and with a preceptor or in the OR. Now, I followed every policy. I'm an employee for Banner Health, so I feel like there is professionalism. If I didn't have it, I wouldn't be working there. When it came to the time to apply for reentry, I wasn't given any details of what I did wrong. They just only generalized that I didn't follow professional conduct. So whatever they gave me, I submitted them to reentry firm, and they denied me for not providing a good case. I don't see how that would be fair, because if I knew what was going on, I would be able to justify it. And even though me finding out of other details, I have justified it, I followed Banner policy. Now, after that, I was talking to the dean, and she asked me to take the fault and just make sure that I justify anything that I have to do to make anything better, even if I didn't agree with it or justified what had happened. I got approved, and I had to wait for the class to restart, which was July. Once that came in, or the date was closer, about May, I requested some lab hours just to get practice to be ready for the next clinical site. And I got the email from Roberta Stanfield that they had reevaluated my application and got denied. So I waited that whole time for, I guess, to be reevaluated. And in between that time, I was being cleared by the secretary, Jessica Buterman, I believe she is, and I was cleared by financial aid too. So everything was set. It was just me waiting for the date.
Okay. All right. Thank you, AM. We appreciate your comments. Committee members, questions? Hearing none. Oh, we have one from Dr. Leck.
Did you, you participated in any type of the process for where they aired out the concerns around your behavior in the initial part, initially, before you were allowed reinstatement later?
I received no information. They weren't able to provide a report. I would see the director, the OR manager at the hospital since I worked there, and I would request information. They would just say to speak to the school, and the school wouldn't give me any information. What I did is I did speak to Nicole Busquet. I can't pronounce it, I did speak to her to justify or what I would plan to do to be more successful. So I did speak to the dean about that.
Thank you.
Dr. Butte.
Yeah, AM, I'm looking for a particular letter, and I think you'll know what it was. There was a letter that you had submitted that was in reference to your character. I can't find a specific letter right now through all the exhibits as I'm moving through them. But who wrote that letter, and what's the relationship to you?
Can I ask where it's coming from to understand
what
you're speaking about?
Let me find it, and I'll re-raise my question as soon as I find it.
Something I can find for you, Dr. Butte?
You know, it was in a letter. It's in the exhibit somewhere. There's many pages of them here. But
was it from my director from the hospital?
I believe so. Yes.
Yes, that is the director at Banner Health. I'm a licensed nursing assistant, and it's justifying me working at Banner Health during the time that I was testing for COVID. So he explains of my position there at the hospital, and that he had approved me working there during the time I was testing for COVID. And he assured in that letter that I followed Banner Health policy.
Thank you. That's the one I was questioning. And what is his relationship to you again?
He was my director for Banner Health.
Okay, thank you.
Any additional questions from the committee? Hearing none, we will move on to institution. I'm not sure who is going to represent the institution, but if you could please introduce yourself and your title and then provide a very brief update.
Sure. I'm Dr. Lou Kavahar. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm the National Dean for Unitech Learning, which is the parent of Brookline College. And the timeline that the student is describing is a little bit different than what we have documented in our records. On August 26, 2022, the nursing manager of the operating room where the student was completing their clinical hours emailed the college and then called the college, and that's based on the timeline we sent to the board, about the student's performance at clinical. And what we do is we give all credence to the feedback that we get from the clinical facility because they are managing the student's clinical at that point. And so at that point, the regional director of Allied Health, the student referred to Roberta Stanfield, that's the regional director of Allied Health, reached out to the student on August 30th to give him some next steps on the reentry process. Now, reentry does not guarantee re-enrollment. So students can submit a reentry application and they still need to go through a reentry process. That's not unfamiliar to the board, I'm sure. On September 6th, the registrar, who's Jessica Biedemann, reached out to the student. And then on the 6th, again on the 7th, and on the 8th of September, many communique went out to the student. That's what we've documented in our records and sent to the boards. Lots of communication as to why we are reaching out to the student, as well as the reasons for being removed from the facility. Now, the due process that was allowed to the student was the reentering committee meeting. That's where the registrar, the campus director, the regional director of Allied Health, and a director from another department met with the student. The student had the opportunity to jump the line in terms of due process, not need to meet with the program director, the regional dean, and then myself. Jump the line and gets a committee of college professionals to plead his case. He did. And the committee then informed the student 24 hours later that what he didn't take ownership of his performance at the clinical facility, and that the charge nurse had explained in detail why he was being removed. Now, that removal is going to come. Now, the college does take responsibility in that Nicole Shea, who is a regional dean of Valley Health, overruled the program director's decision to disallow the student to reenter. The student did file an application for reentry after the committee had denied him. The regional dean overruled that reentry committee, which is not part of our leadership processes. She's no longer with the facility. She's no longer with the college. And the regional dean that took over for Ms. Bousquet is Mr. Benson, Bradley Benson. And Bradley Benson followed policy. And because of the depth of the code of conduct violation, upheld the committee's decision. Now, what's happened with the communication with the student is that the student was approved for reentry. Part of the reentry process was that the business office reaches out to clear up any balance you have on your accounts. The campus director reached out and the student hung up on her. The campus director called back and couldn't get the student on the phone. But at that point, Mr. Bradley has already made the decision to follow the reentry committee's recommendations and not allow for reentry to the program. And that's where we are some months later.
Thank you.
Sure.
Members of the committee, questions? Dr. Vite.
Yeah, I have a question regarding the rules at the site. There was a concern around the motivation for AM in between OR assignments. Is there a rule or guideline that states what the student should be doing in between given assignments?
When the student reports to the clinical facility, which is not unlike all clinical facility regulations, that the student has to be engaged in the assignment that's given by the nursing manager, in this case, the OR nursing manager. The notification that we received from the nursing manager is that the student was found walking into rooms where he was not assigned. This is what we sent to the board. That's what they documented, the hospital documented, and that wouldn't be grounds to remove this student. We wouldn't remove a student because of motivation. We remove the student because of the other factors that the students already described. Calling in for the shift and then being found in the cafeteria or seen by other employees at the hospital that knows the student and knew the nurse manager who reported it to the nurse manager, and not showing up for the assignments that he was required to complete. And the lack of motivation compounded by all of these other reasons were justification enough to not continue this person in the program.
Okay, so in the statement where it indicated that AM was not motivated because he was in the lounge in between assignments, my question is, what is the guidance that's provided that students should be doing in between assignments?
The student is required to follow the directions provided by the clinical site supervisor. And yeah, so they don't have to clear that with the college. As long as the student is following the directions of the clinical site supervisor, the student will do very well and shouldn't have been marked down for motivation. But they don't communicate the specific assignment instructions to the college. We sign an agreement with the facility to manage the student's performance when they're at the OR. They don't respond back to us and tell us minute by minute what that student's doing.
Right. So in the interest of time, I'm going to try to go a little bit quick here. I'm not intending anything by it.
Sure.
So my understanding was there was...
For a moment, I did see Assistant Attorney General Galvin had her hand raised. I don't know if she wanted to make a legal comment.
Not a legal, just wanted to let you know on page 10 of the student complaint is the letter from Banner.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry, Dr. Boutte, continue.
Quite all right. By report from AM, there were times where there were no OR assignments provided. And in that case, AM did take initiative to find their own. Also, that it does appear that in those times where there was time to be sitting in the lounge, there was not anything given. So it was just a question of
sure.
When there are opportunities when nothing has been given, what is the expectation? And if nothing has been given, there's a challenge for me about making that a lack of motivation. The second question that I have that I want to lean into is there is a statement that indicated in one of the emails that, quote, all reentry applications had been reevaluated or were being reevaluated. And I'm curious if anyone else who had been approved was also retroactively denied.
That's it only happened to this one student.
Thank you.
Now, I just want to recommit to that the note that the nursing manager wrote. He disappears from the department and no one knows where he is when the OR procedures are scheduled. That's a violation of practice in terms of our expectations for a student who is on clinical. He should have followed instructions from the charge nurse. He's been absent from his clinical rotations for some time now. We thought he had COVID, he tested negative, and then he showed up in the cafeteria of the hospital. We give all weight to the externship site supervisor who says the student's not performing to our level of expectations. Now, the site supervisor could have just failed the student, and the student would have been sent to another externship facility. That's not what this clinical nurse manager described. Not a student that wasn't performing academically, a student that was absent from the process, and when they were looking for him, went missing.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Leck?
So, again, used to this stuff. So when I read through, I'm skipping the motivation because I don't think that agree. That's not a thing, right?
Right.
As far
right.
as any bounds. But the rest of it clearly would be a violation of the clinical component. What I don't understand, and maybe you can help clarify for me, is that when you have the site and you do have the site, you know, running in the student is really a guest of that site, but I'm also used to the institution having a clinical faculty who is also there. Do you have clinical faculty that are visiting the location and overseeing that as well and also providing that, you know, the institutional part of correcting behavior at that location too?
Yeah, thanks, Dr. Luck. I appreciate that question. The program we're talking about is Surgical Technology Degree Program, and it's programmatically accredited, and having been programmatically accredited, has a program director, a clinical coordinator, and the faculty. The clinical coordinator circulates throughout the different clinical facilities where students are present. The clinical coordinator isn't present the entire time because the clinical facility has a nurse manager and a clinical team responsible for that student's education.
But would you not send your clinical coordinator out then to the location if they were saying that this is a problem for them to be able to also own the issue?
That's correct. And yes, and thanks for pointing that out. We definitely would have done that. We spoke to the facility. The phone calls that took place were enough for us to make the decision. We reached out to the student repeatedly, and the student failed to return any communication from the college. It wasn't until the reentry meeting where the student said, and it's in the packet that we sent to you, he didn't think it was important because he thought the college was just calling him about timesheets.
Hmm.
Timesheets.
Okay, so my last question before I turn it back over is, it seems like the issue here is an administrator who inserted themselves into it. So if they had followed through and given the committee the authority to approve or deny a reentry, would the student have been able to appeal, or do you have an appeal process where they can do that and ask for that additional oversight? And did that or did that not happen?
Yeah, so we do have a level progressive appeal process in place, well documented in the catalog. And yes, the student could have appealed the decision of the reentry committee. Some time had passed, 45 days had passed between the reentry committee decision, and so it sat with the student for over a month, and the decision the regional dean made to overturn the committee's decision. So the student could have applied for an appeal. It could have appealed the decision. We have a due process. We have due process in place.
But in this case, okay, so let me just go through the timeline in my head. The committee said don't re-enter. The person above them said yes, re-enter. So then the student wouldn't have anything to appeal. It wouldn't be until later where the head person said no, that wasn't per process, and it had to be sticking with the committee. That's the point at which the student would have an appeal over their ability to re-enter.
That's right.
The student at that point where they said, no, we didn't follow process and we need to retro, right? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. I get you. So the decision to uphold the committee's denial, yeah, after the fact of the regional dean making the decision, the student met with the regional dean. That's the next level up on the appeals process. So they had a face-to-face. The regional dean asked the student to go away, think about what they had discussed, and email me back with instructions on what you understand is really going on with this code of conduct violation. This is sometime after the college has said to the student again, no, you can't re-enter because of a code violation. So the student is engaged with the regional dean, Benson Bradley, at that point. And so the conversation took place at that point, and the decision was upheld, and the student was speaking with the regional dean.
And did the student do the thing that they indicated they need to go back through and think about?
No. We have no documentation from the student, and none in the records that we sent to the board.
And when did that happen? When did those meetings occur? So I have it.
One second. Let me go through the timeline. May 5th.
May 5th. Okay. Of last year.
2023, that year.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a long timeline. We sent a large packet to the board.
Okay.
I see.
I defer back.
All right. For the committee, any additional questions? Hearing none, would there be a motion that someone would like to entertain? AM, unless the board has an additional question for you, we're moving on from statements. So either Dr. Boutet or Dr. Leck, any additional questions for AM?
I don't have any.
Hearing none, then is there a motion?
I'm trying to figure out how to attempt to maybe do like Mike had suggested earlier in an attempt to resolve this. It sounds like the school owns the process to where someone inserted themselves in and overrode the process as stated and attempted to correct that. And then it sounds like at the back end where the your regional dean was working with the student to attempt to resolve it, nothing went past that. So might a motion be that the student and that regional dean attempt to reengage and work through your appeals process one last time to determine if there's an outcome for both parties, and then if not, move it to the full board after that?
So the motion then would be to, if the parties can seek a resolution between now and April, this would still be referred to the committee, to the full board in April. But if it's resolved, that can be determined at that particular time. If it's not, then they would go before the full board. Is that in a nutshell?
Dr. Leck, can you ask Dr. Kabuta if that's even an option? If it's not an option, there's no reason to move it to the board for further review. If that's an option for them, then yeah, but you'd be wasting your time to re-reviewing stuff if that's not even an option.
Thank you for the question. It won't change the outcome. So in the notes on May 8th, the regional dean wrote, although he is writing this email, sending it to me today, Alberto understands that the situation will not likely change and he will not become a part of the Search Check program again.
Okay. So that statement there states then, Dr. Leck, if you would like to just make an amended motion where we just bring it to the board. April.
Dr. Leck, if you feel that there's a possible violation of a statute or rule, you can move it to the board.
I'm challenged because I don't think that there is a, to me, when I read it from the clinical location, there's clearly clinical violations there. So I think that those have to be dealt with because these are like life and death kind of jobs. And so I don't feel like that's that. The only part that is a problem is someone, they could have, if someone asserted their authority over a committee, right, and then it was corrected because that wasn't the right thing, and that person's not even here. I just don't know what we can do about that. Right, they corrected their process, but I don't think that anything was.
So the option, Dr. Leck and Dr. Boutet, is to dismiss, at the complaint committee level, or move it forward if you believe that there's an issue that, as Mr. Blanchard stated, that there was some type of a violation that the school may have committed, that would then, you would defer to the entire board to hear that. And we would, move that forward in April.
Yeah, so I'll just say that as someone who's unfamiliar with the clinical requirements, I definitely have to defer that aspect to Dr. Leck. I have a piece that feels like there is some lack of equity that has occurred based on what I read, that there could have been further opportunity for more understanding to create a path forward, and I'm not in this clinical space. So that comes from a standpoint of, equitability within how
students are treated and opportunities are given. And there's some of this that feels like there was some miscommunication that led to some challenge. And that's what's concerning me at the moment. But those clinical pieces are significant. I understand that.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you in the communication issue is around the actual reentry part, not the issue about the clinical performance part. So understanding that the significance of the clinical performance part is a big deal. So maybe we refer it to the full committee so that.
Dr. Leck, if we could. Perhaps just, I saw Assistant Attorney General Jean Galvin has raised her hand, so maybe she could provide some guidance.
And that's sort of where I was going. It seems like we have two committee members here. You're vacillating. Having a few more board members review this could help inform you.
Thank you.
Agreed.
So just to
read. I motion that thing happen.
So the motion would be then, to sum it up, to move this to the full board in April.
For consideration.
Okay. So that we have a motion, which I can't make. So Dr. Leck or Dr. Boudet, if you would like to make that.
I make a motion that we move this to the full board so that there are additional committee members besides poor me and Dr. Boudet to attempt to sort out if the process isn't, we're all followed.
All right. So we have a motion, and we're looking for a second.
I'll second that.
All right, the Dr. Boutte will second that. Any further discussion? Hearing none, we will go through a vote. Mr. Romano. Mr. Romano abstains. Dr. Leck?
Aye.
Dr. Leck votes aye. Dr. Boutte?
Aye.
Dr. Boutte votes aye by the vote of two ayes, one abstention. That motion passes. For the institution, we'll provide you more information for the April board meeting that you'll be required to attend. That concludes the complaint portion. Just a quick, we do have a call to the public. Public comment is encouraged. Presentation be limited to 5 minutes. Please be aware, however, that the committee may not discuss, consider, or take action at this meeting on any item not scheduled on the agenda. During the meeting, additional public comment may be required, but it is generally not allowed. Are there any members that would like to? No, you can't go yet, Dr. Leck. Give me one more minute. Because I will lose quorum. We haven't adjourned yet. So, any members of the public? Hearing none, seeing none, we can adjourn the meeting at 3:06 p.m. and Jennifer can go out and root on the GCU. There you go. In the Sweet 64 or number 64 or whatever the tournament is. So enjoy.
Thank you. Sorry, guys.
All right.
Alberto, I'll be with you next week. Alberto, what's next?
Thank you, Keith.
Bye, everybody. Take care. Bye.
Right, thank you.
Thank you.